This is the podcast where the huge potential and latent opportunity that's awakening in the east of England is given a good shake and handed a double espresso, because our time is now. Welcome to Eastern Promise. Greetings and welcome to episode 58 of Eastern Promise, where my guest this week is Asher Minns, Executive Director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research at the University of East Anglia. Although Asher will be sharing a deeply sobering analysis of the state of our climate, he'll also be setting out why the East of England has a pivotal role in delivering a clean, decarbonised economy. Staying with the UEA, we'll also be talking to contestants, mentors and judges at the grand finale of the 2023 Changemakers event, held earlier this month at the university's iconic Enterprise Centre. And finally, where in the east of England do you go to be sporty? Don't be out for a duck, be in for some crowd sorcery. By virtue of geography and meteorology, the east of England is mission critical to meeting the UK's net zero commitments and successfully decarbonising our economy. It's worth unpacking that for a moment. In the United Kingdom, today, the success of what is, or should be at any rate, the defining social, political and scientific endeavour of our times is wholly dependent on the east of England playing its part, more so than any other region or nation in the UK. Dependent on our huge capacity for renewable energy generation. Dependent on our proximity to other major conurbations, such as London. And dependent on the scientific work being done in our region to track climate change and advise on the measures needed to fight it. Is that a touch overblown? A bit heavy on the hyperbole? You know, I thought so at first. But then I sat down with my guest today, Asher Minns, Executive Director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research at the University of East Anglia, to find out how much we needed to do, but also our capacity here in the east of England to get the job done. Asher Minns, Executive Director of the Tyndall Climate Research Institute. Thank you very much for being on Eastern Promise. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Thank you for coming in.
Could you just give us a very quick potted history of Asher Minns, please?
So I've had a varied career, but for the last 20 years, I have been working for the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research, which is based here at the University of East Anglia. But it is a partnership of UK universities. So we're here at the UEA, the sort of coordinating hub, and our research goes on here. We're also at Manchester University, we're also at Newcastle University, and we're also at Cardiff University. And the reason that we're distributed in this way is because back in 2000, when the Tyndall Centre was founded, we are the first interdisciplinary centre, which means we take different expertises and mash them all together to hopefully give policymakers and decision makers research that's done in the round. Academic research quite traditionally tends to kind of be quite siloed and look at its own specific thing, but that doesn't really apply to the wide world very well. So the Tyndall Centre, as far as I know, we were the first institute to do that, to bring together different expertise, engineers, environmental scientists, social scientists, economists, into one partnership so that when we were doing research, we were looking across the piece rather than just one isolated piece of knowledge. However, that's the Tyndall Centre. You actually asked me about me. Right at the beginning, I'm very, very, very old. Right at the beginning, I'm actually an engineer. So I started off as a radar engineer and have done various things and ended up in science and research.
Oh, it's fascinating how people sort of wind up in places. Could you just talk us through how the centre came to be located here in Norwich and in the east of England?
The building we're sitting in at the moment, which is listeners imagine a sort of large bean can type building with a glass roof, that's where we are, and that's it's the Hubert Lam Building, better known as the Climatic Research Unit. Hubert Lam was the person who founded the Climatic Research Unit, and the Climatic Research Unit, a bit like the Tyndall Centre, but we're going back further now because the Climatic Research Unit is marking its 50th anniversary. That was the first centre to be looking at what is happening in the climate. So really it was meteorologists or weathermen who came together thinking, there seems to be something going on here that's more than just to do with weather. It's longer term. So they started putting together that sort of that longer term evidence, that longer term data to see, well, is there anything happening? And so the reason it's headquartered at the University of East Anglia is this long track record of climate change research at the University of East Anglia, starting off with, is something happening? Very sort of curiosity driven, through to where we are now, which is far beyond the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research. It's the UK has an Act of Parliament. There's a 20 something countries that now have climate change Acts of Parliament. There is the United Nations Paris Agreement, which of 2015, 196 countries of the world got together and agreed to reduce emissions and to try and limit the amount of global warming that was going on. So, you know, in a very roundabout but also quite a linear route, you could say it started here in this building where you're currently sitting, out to the United Nations Paris Agreement, out to all these climate change acts, out to every paper talking about climate change in some way, whether it's a business paper or a popular tabloid, going, it's scorching because there's a heat wave, and is it climate change? So, you know, that kind of started here in this building.
I mean, it's very interesting because just only last night, hearing on the news that the Competition and Markets Authority is going to look again at antitrust legislation to allow companies to collaborate on sustainability measures. And that strikes me as, and I know many listeners will find that that's hugely important, because I think, in my experience, it's been, yes, campaigners and academics and also the private and the business sector that have really kind of been driving action forward to an extent that policymakers are sort of almost trying to catch up. Is that fair? Is that your experience? Or do you have a more nuanced view?
Mostly the nature of Tyndall Centre work is that we've mostly worked with policymakers, because in a way that was who we were doing the research for, and to grab or to, you know, get the attention of, raise awareness of why this is an important topic. So the Tyndall Centre has been in it for a long time, as I said. But with that, there's always been business interest and business discourse. And I think that probably is where you can see, you know, if we mapped it, you could see much more growth in business discourse now, and business interest and business talking about net zero and some of these things that are almost slightly commonplace terminology, not exactly down the pub, but... And with the idea of sort of reducing emissions as much as you can, is actually financial incentives from government and and to try and make it happen, whether that's around energy or retrofitting or whatever it is. So I think there's a a whole piece there, and it all has to be plugged in together. And the other thing from a business perspective is not only is it good for business values, it's also completely necessary. There's no choice but to reduce emissions. And also there's a huge market in that as well, because their business gets involved in things where there is money to be made, and there clearly is, and that's why so many businesses are getting more involved. Either that's because of their reputation or their business values, or actually they're working in the field whereby we have a new technology, we have a new idea, we have a new approach. And so that's why, another reason that business is coming on board.
Yeah, and it's also the renewable energy sources are, especially at the moment, a great way to cut costs. I mean, we at home, we put solar panels on in July, and it's incredible. We bought a travel kettle now, because it draws enough that it does it for nothing, basically, mm-hmm. from the panels. You briefed, the Tyndall Centre, rather, briefed the all-party parliamentary group for the East of England. I came across a briefing that struck me as it was a fantastic briefing. You were briefing them that the region is critical to the success of decarbonisation due to our renewable energy resources. How can we support, how is the Tyndall Centre and the rest of society, how can we support those policymakers? And is there still work to do with, I can sort of speak from some experience with some policymakers?
Actually, I wrote that briefing, so I know it quite well, if I can remember it. It was only a few months ago I wrote it, but I've probably written a lot more since. So I have a particular interest in the East of England, not only because I live here, but I've also, maybe we'll talk about it separate, but I'm also the co-chair of the Norwich Climate Commission.
Indeed.
But we'll come to that separately. Apart from to say that I've decided that I'm trying to do a lot more locally and regionally than I have been in my Tyndall Centre career up to now. I've mostly been quite international, international more even than national. And so I'm very interested in applying theory to practice of into this region, of what it is we know and how that might be used in this region with the expertise of lots of other people as well, not just academic expertise. I think if I had my briefing has several messages to the policymakers, to the East of England group. I think one of the main ones, I'm going to pick on two, I think, mm-hmm. Is the East of England is absolutely critical to the UK achieving its climate change targets. It can't be done without the East of England because of its renewable energy out in the North Sea, which is already happening, lots and lots of turbines and wind farms going on out in the North Sea. It's got lots of land for solar as well. So there's the generating of the power that's needed. There's also all that power really needs to be got down to London and the South East. So there's some major grid capacity. People have heard of the national grids and some maybe grid capacity to get that down to where the people are. So that has to come through our region So that's one of them is kind of, I don't know, almost how central the East of England is to the entire UK Climate Act, mm-hmm. Climate Change Act, and achieving the net zero targets. So that's the first one, kind of bigging up the role of the East of England, which sometimes people might say seems to get a bit neglected. Then the second one is that, so that's all about reducing carbon emissions, the net zero target, which is clearly a huge part of climate change and is very important for all sorts of reasons, not only for climate change, but for reducing air pollution, for energy independence. We're seeing right now what happens when you get all your power from other countries. Eminent professors were talking about this 20 years ago, the lack of UK energy independence, and people are paying for that right now. Yeah. It needn't have been like that. So there's that sort of whole net zero, energy independence, energy security, where the East of England has a big role to play, or a central role to play. There's also adaptation to climate risk. So we're in Norfolk, very, very flat. The coast is made of marzipan, which erodes away as soon as a wave laps against it. Mm-hmm. The East of England is sinking because Scotland is rising, and it's the weight of the last glaciation. I mean, Scotland is rising and the southeast of England is sinking. So a combination of coastal erosion because of what the coast is made out of, sea level rise, both from the sinking of the land and the expanding of water as it gets warmer because of global warming, which goes on for thousands of years. So sea level rise isn't something that if we turned off all the carbon dioxide taps yesterday, it stops. It goes on for millennia.
Yeah.
So this is something that's happening already and is continuing to happen. Then we have big agricultural area, so very vulnerable to extremes of weather, heat waves, drought, mm-hmm. wildfires, all of which we have seen this last summer. The region already doesn't have enough water. So it's a drought region, and that's not going to get any better, and that's not going to get any better because of house building targets either. So it's an area of population growth. So there are lots and lots of things I could go on and on and on about why the East of England and Norfolk and probably Suffolk as well are particularly vulnerable
yes.
to the impacts of climate change. I see Norfolk as being on the front line of climate change. It's the most vulnerable county in the UK to the impacts of climate change, both now, because it's sort of maladapted now, and to the climate change that's happening into the future. Yeah. So there's the whole central to reducing emissions for the as a part of a national effort for the UK and locally, and then there's the adapting to the impacts of climate change, which is as critical for Norfolk and Suffolk more so probably than anywhere in the UK.
So effectively, we've got a triptych, haven't we, of necessity, opportunity, and vulnerability, and it's I think incumbent on us, and I'll just ask you to reflect on this, by embracing the opportunity. I mean, it's 70 years since the 1953 floods, if I've got my math correctly.
It is.
And I always worry about that. And, you know, should have been sooner, but an appropriate moment to sort of take stock of that vulnerability. I was at the Norfolk Farming Conference, and General the Lord Dannock who's chair of the, hope I get this right, Norfolk Strategic Flooding Alliance, and sort of talking about that, the water issue. And do you think that the cost of living crisis being sort of front and centre of the news, when it's not various government ministers getting themselves in bother, isn't this a great moment to sort of marry that all up and say, you want to cut costs, you want to stick it to Putin, you want to boost the economy of the East of England, and you want to address climate change, ding, 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 ding. You're on a winner here.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't want to be that annoying, we told you so.
Why not?
But I'm going to be.
And, do it.
And there is no reason that the UK couldn't be energy independent, certainly in electricity. And that should have happened by now.
Yeah.
You know, you might still have to get some from other sources, and that just takes vision and in investment. But look what happens if you don't do vision and investment in these realms.
Yeah.
You know, the cost of living crisis isn't even with us yet. You know, the huge hikes in interest rates aren't with most people yet, because that'll be coming as their mortgage terms complete, or that, you know, the current mortgage arrangement. So you know, we've not even seen the beginning. Now, not all of that is purely to do with energy, but somebody should do the analysis of how much of that is down to energy when people's gas is you know, increased by four times and things like this on people that don't have much money to begin with. So I think there's of course, bound to say, Anna, listen to your academics, because actually, you know, sometimes they have got some useful things to say. But that's not necessarily just academics within universities. That's, you know, very skilled people within government departments. The people who kind of really know the field, and it's beyond politics. I think that's one of the things about climate. It isn't political.
It doesn't care, does it?
Yes,
really?
Yes, yeah.
It doesn't care the colour of your rosette. It doesn't care what your plans for the weekend are. It doesn't care about whether, you know, people want that pile on there or not. It would be very easy for me to join you, go down there. But what I want to come back to is, I mean, first of all, you've got a place like Cornwall Insight, also in Norwich. You've got the energy and you know, yourselves here. What a great, you know, very proud of that, even if at the moment the news is not spectacularly encouraging. But the vision statement for the Tyndall Centre, I was really struck by when I read through. And the aim a bit of the centre, it says, to see ongoing scientific research support society making a timely transition to a sustainable low-carbon future. It was the word timely that jumped out for me. What would you define as timely? Would yesterday be timely?
Yeah, we keep having to revise our timelines. I think that the vision statement actually hasn't... It's been tweaked a bit, but it hasn't changed much over the last 20 years, really. I don't think it's always... Which is, you know, that's quite a good vision statement. On the other hand, it's a bit of a failure of a vision statement, because what we have hoped that wider society would achieve, this is just down to the Tyndall Centre, hasn't really happened. It absolutely is accelerating, but nothing is accelerating fast enough, whether that is to do with a low carbon future and energy independence, or with adapting to the impacts of climate change as well. And so I think, you know, if we go just back to 2015, which isn't that long ago, when the Paris Agreement seeks to limit global warming to between 1.5 and 2 degrees, we're now at 1.1 degrees of global warming. So that's not very far from 1.5 degrees. So therefore, all efforts made that are possible to try and globally, this isn't just an East Anglian question, to globally limit temperature rise to whatever it can be. But we do know that temperature is already increasing, 1.1 degrees, and is going to increase further. And we are seeing the impacts of that, whether it's flooding in Pakistan or wildfires in California and plenty of other places. But when we bring that home to Norfolk, only repeating myself, Norfolk is at the front line of climate change in the UK, whether it be energy or coping with the risks.
Another thing that interested me was that the extent to which the centre can, and you and your colleagues can map out the ends of where we need to be, but you have to kind of, I don't want to say soft pedal on the means, but leave the kind of the means to policymakers, and to what extent the kind of the TikTok the inexorable march of all the things you've laid out, which won't be stopped and don't care about the electoral cycle, forces you into a more, passionate debate, discussion over those means. And it was just it was intrigued by that, where that line is drawn, and where you feel that, do you feel the need to keep redrawing it as time ticks by?
A lot of our work, because it's, well, all our work even, is looking into the future now and into the future, and this includes 20 years ago, is about scenarios. What are the scenarios into the future? The different scenarios around climate, around temperature, around rainfall, all of which are dependent on how much emissions go into the atmosphere, all of which is dependent on how much fossil fuels are burnt, how much deforestation goes on, what the population is, what their energy needs are. So there's a lot of scenario building that kind of uses, you know, supercomputers, because this is really, really, really complicated math. And so those scenarios map out into the, or they map out different futures using the best available evidence for what those different futures might be. But it's always a range of scenarios. So it's, these happen under these certain conditions. And as an independent or a research organisation, our role is to show policy and or other decision makers, in a very wider sense, what those different choices are. So we're not there to make the choices of policymakers, decision makers. That's their expertise. That's what they're for. But we can certainly show the range, what we think is the, you know, the most likely ranges of what's going to happen under different scenarios, different projections into the future. But having said that, it's not that we're sitting on the fence and at all. We're absolute advocates for climate action. And so this is, and that's something that, you know, has to be done. We advocate for that very much, and advocate for sort of better knowledge and better research. But those decisions have to be taken in the round of the expertises of who the other, who the decision maker is, whether that's business person or policy maker. So we're making our decisions within the realms of climate and energy, not necessarily economy and bottom line and other things.
So just to go to back to the vision statement, which again is brilliant and is I think is really strong, and it says Paris Agreement presents a clear challenge for the research community to find achievable pathways of global decarbonisation without impeding prosperity, security and development. I mean, you've gone into this already, but I just wanted you to reflect, and I know you already have, but reflect on whether we need, whether we are paying enough attention to regionally and nationally to the potential of renewable energy, of a source of all of the above. And you say you have already covered that, but I'm going to ask the question because I've written it down already.
Yeah, I think it's... I'm just going to have a cough, sorry.
That's all right, go for it.
I think that part of the vision statement, what we're trying to do is talk about sort of the interconnectedness of all things. So we're talking about poverty and livelihoods, vulnerabilities, and that all of that comes into the round, this sort of interdisciplinary nature of the Tyndall Centre that I was talking about. So I think that's. And yeah, we're trying to work this out as well. We don't have all the answers. We're a research organisation. We're trying to discover new stuff or new ways of looking at stuff.
That's fantastic.
Is that it's not connected together enough, whether that's in academia, where we're sitting right now, or into wider policy making and decision making. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to come down back to where Eastern Promise to make an Eastern example. Is that everybody knows, listening to this programme, there's some really wealthy areas in this region and there's a lot of poverty in this region. And, of course, it's the poorer people that are most vulnerable to all these changes in energy prices and the cost of living crisis and, in some ways, maybe less so now, but... traditionally, and you were talking about the 1953 floods, that was poor people. that were mostly flooded because it was poor people who lived in cheap, not very well-made houses on the coast. That's kind of changed a bit now, where there's holiday homes and grand designs and things. Not entirely. I don't want to
say that to
everybody. But then we have got coastal communities that are a little bit out there and are poorer, and they are still the most vulnerable as well to the impact of climate change. So talking about sort of livelihoods, and we don't have to go all the way to Bangladesh to be thinking about poverty and what climate means for poor places. We have to think about Bangladesh and research out there, and colleagues do, but also we can just take a little train ride out to our coasts here and see quite similar scenarios being played now out into the future. So it's trying to encompass everything we can into joined up decision making, so that both science and decisions, or at least policy choices, are not made in isolation and siloed, because then you'd just end up, policymakers or whoever, just end up playing whack-a-mole. You know, they'd hit this one and something else pops up here.
Yeah.
That's not how the environment and the Earth system works.
No, I know. It's as Bill Bailey says, it's a Mock's-Our brief dance on the surface. One of the couple of things that interested me, well, it was a surprise for me. I took my daughter to a trampoline, her trampoline group, a shout-out for Dragons Trampoline Club there, at a South Norfolk Leisure Centre last night. And I was a bit taken aback at the number of people who were in the sports hall before us for what was effectively a warm bank.
Yes.
It was a warm hub.
Yes,
And it was just the number, and South Norfolk is one of the wealthier districts. But as well, I went out to Orbis Energy at Lowestoft, sort of the tail end of last summer, I think, and to interview EMPs there on the work that Generate are doing. And we were talking about LEAF, which is this sort of the investment in infrastructure for bigger ships to service more wind turbines out at sea. And I was observing to him that more ships mean more crew, mean more people in the town looking for a bacon sandwich and a cup of coffee, means, more people need jobs to look after, clean the crew facilities on shore, to drive things to load the boats, etc., etc. So the more investment that investment in infrastructure of renewable energy will sort of drive, and you eventually you get more people being taken on in the coffee shops and the restaurants and the shops, because more people are flowing through, and it's that kind of, I'm going to say, virtuous circle of prosperity coming outwards from the renewable energy investment. And it just strikes me as such a rich vein of potential that, we are getting energy that won't stop. People can sort of go, oh, the wind doesn't always blow. But energy that's renewable, and, in essence, I watched a very good YouTube talk that someone from the Environment Agency clued me into. In essence, it'll be free. It can be free if the policymakers can have the vision for it. What a wonderful way of spreading out prosperity from the renewable energy. And in as you say, the most vulnerable, some of the poorer districts, we're talking about Lowestoft, Yarmouth, and that part of the coast, and the slow, I hope it doesn't need to be gentrification, but the slow improvement of infrastructure, that will flow from that. And you can sort of see this cascade. They've already got CFAS there. They've just got a new ship. Wonderful. How wonderful is that? I should invite you to reflect on that screed I've just blurted out.
Yeah, I think there's quite a lot there.
I'm sorry.
I think, so there's... Yes, definitely there's... that's always quite a classic sort of vision of growth, So you get investment in somewhere, and that does knock on into the local economy, be it jobs, accommodation, perhaps bringing skills into the area that weren't previously there, that sort of thing, and then smaller businesses start up or start servicing the bigger businesses, and so yes. Absolutely, and like I said, I think that's quite sort of classical, you know, how to look at growth. I think there's also a lot more to growth and things like a good economy. Because there we're having maybe quite sort of top-down, drip-down economics, which works as well, absolutely does work.
Not trickle-down, I hope.
but also about, you know, having good jobs and quality jobs, and maybe even, this is far from my area of expertise, I'm giving an opinion here, is to try and use local supply chains as much as possible. So I'll take a local example, very local example, because we're in Norwich, which is the East Norwich development, mm-hmm. which is 50 hectares, from people who know Norwich, or the rail station down along the river, sort of down towards in the Trouse direction where Britvic and Coleman's used to be. So that's 50 hectares, a sort of post-industrial waste site. That's going to be completely completely developed.
Yes.
Into, you know, housing, shops, homes, schools, whatever it is, it's going to be. As far as I'm aware, 50 hectares is the biggest sort of inner city urban development in England and Wales. You know, 50 hectares is huge. It's going to take decades to build all that. There's different parcels of land. But the reason I sort of bring that into this conversation here about economies is that will be a big growth place, of course. But the development of that should also be completely low carbon. If it's going to be 6,000 homes, well, let's have 6,000 net zero homes. Mm-hmm. It's right on the river. We've already talked about adaptation, mm-hmm. coastal flooding, water coming up rivers, water flowing down rivers. So it has to be built to be coping with floods. We have talked about lack of drinking water. So it also has to be very low consumption in water as well. Ideally, not huge car parks and things like that for the 6,000 homes or however many it's going to be. So to be done very holistically. And if that development, it is happening or will happen, how to shorten those supply chains so that it's local firms doing as much as that as possible so the money stays in the economy. If it's going to be whatever heat, I'm not going to talk about the heating system, but if whatever heating system is put into there, then, well, why not train up the skills to have that done by current youth who will be a little bit older by that. So for that, exactly taking the economic example you're giving, which is investment, effectively, to go into, well, how to use that investment in the most useful way to grow the local economy for forever. Because in the case of East Norwich, if those homes were built to current standards, they're obsolete before anybody has signed on the mortgage and got the keys.
Exactly.
Because they're going to be high energy consumption, they're not going to be net zero, and they're not going to be adapted to flooding, and they're going to use lots of water and all this sort of thing. So I think there's looking at good economy, you know, looking at economics in the round as well.
I mean, you make an excellent point. I mean, we've got Goldsmith Street here in Norwich, which I'm hopefully trying to arrange to go and have a quick tour mm-hmm. around. And I know there are some who are a bit sniffy about the cost, but, you know, it's got national, international attention. And again, it's Norwich, Norfolk and the east of England, nailing its colours to that mast. And it's something to be hugely proud of. That said, and I say this as someone who yesterday lit his wood burner and who lives in a village in the middle of Breckland, who is dependent on the car. I mean, it's a 5-6 minute car journey to the nearest bus stop, and I do get the bus when I can and the train when I can. But do you think, to what extent have we, and I think I know what you're going to say already, so I asked the blinking question already, to what extent are we fetishising that sort of chocolate box? rural idyll, and you know, the I won't say the thatched roof, but basically they look lovely, but they leak energy. They cost a bomb to heat. I remember years ago, 2017, a guy called Bob Tomlinson from Village Makers came and sort of put a I organised a conference in my former role for How Should Norfolk Grow. And he puts up a picture of a chocolate box property where he is in Devon. He says, people want this, but it costs, you know, X cost a bomb to heat, insure, blah, 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 blah. Put a passive house up and said, don't want this. But, you know, I mean, that may be changing in the environment we're in. But to what extent are we going to have to draw back on that sort of fetishization of that kind of decades, centuries of a rural way of life and start to think about it differently? With different homes that look different, or are we going to sort of? I'll let you answer the question in a second. But find a way to make retrofit and make energy efficient properties look like the ones that people kind of want to sign up for.
Yeah, I think. Certainly. I don't know. Is it the English? Not even the British, I think. The English, I get what you're talking about, this sort of chocolate box, sort of rural idyll, which isn't where most people live, because most people are in towns and,
yes, indeed,
towns and cities, but there is still this vision, I guess. I think maybe, from my perspective, it's from my own personal perspective, it's slightly the wrong question, because for me, climate change is everything change. And so, you know, the climate is already changing, which means everything changes. You know, the food we eat, what it is we can grow, how we move around, what it is we're thinking about, you know, maybe even the way children are educated. You know, so just everything changes with climate change. And so that's not to say that older buildings can't be preserved or retrofitted or something, but it's not an either or. They're both... they're both going to happen and they're both going to change. And realistically, in terms of emissions, it's all in the cities and the towns. So some village homes having large uses of energy isn't showing up very much in the global carbon budget, particularly. But I think those will change over time anyway. As technologies develop and people's habits change and as people desire other ways of living, homes will change themselves. But I would also sort of put in the thought that a lot of the reason we have these older homes. And I live in a bog standard Victorian two up, two down terrace in Norwich, as does a lot of people in Norwich and the rest of the rest of the country, is because of overinvestment in property by the Victorians. They built to good standards and perhaps in old farmhouses made of stone or whatever. They built the best they could at that moment in time. And that's why people are still living in homes built in 1700 or 1600 or 1500, and why I'm living in a sort of 1900s late Victorian terrace, and as are loads and loads of people in Norwich and every other city, because they did the best they could. And they're not supposed to be there. None of these properties are supposed to be there. So we pay hundreds of thousands of pounds for two up, two down Victorian terrace homes. None of them are supposed to be there, because that's not... But the Victorians were just building the best they could. And that's why they're still standing. And that's why they still work, although they've now got plumbing and electricity and central heating and things like that. But it's about building the best you can, because you can. And I think that is something that has to be thought about by city, you know, or planners, or city planners, councillors who sign off on what it is that the planners have recommended, architects, all the people involved in this, builders themselves, the people putting together building regulations. Think about building a cathedral that will still be there in 500 years' time, not a kind of mobile home.
Yeah,
you know, and I think there is a difference in approach. And if you are only going to build for something to be there in only 50 years' time, then make sure it can be taken apart, recycled, and then the new property with all the new standards put on top of that. So sort of things that can be dismantled rather than having to be smashed up and turned into motorway hardcore or something. There's so many different ways of doing things that aren't what's traditional, but traditional doesn't work with climate change.
I was a very good example of that, actually. Been following from inception, actually, a chap called Robert Ashton, who's an author, who's recently been granted planning permission to build an earth-surrounded home, which you won't be able to see from the road, but it will be completely self-sufficient, carbon negative, which is carbon neutral, and power itself, get its own water, etc., etc. And I've been sort of every so often I go around to see him and record a little update. So hopefully we will put that together and eventually have a journey from the idea all the way through, and recorded the planning committee where they all sat around and said, "Oh, this, we need more of this." And I know in South Norfolk there's often been, and I've commented on this on the podcast many times, some agitation about, for example, the gap between Heatherset and Wyndham and it being left so they are distinct settlements. To which my answer is, this guy's building the answer. If you can't see it from the road, the gap's better plan it out now for with properties like these that makes it look like the gap is still there, then let it be piecemeal nibbled away at. And at least you've got net, you know, fantastic properties. And it's maintaining the sense of two distinct settlements. Could you talk to us about your work on the Norwich Climate Commission, which you mentioned earlier? And I must say, I read the interview you did with Tom Bristow of the Norwich Seeker.
Oh, yeah.
So a hat tip to him. Talk to us about your work on that.
So we started a year ago, pretty much, actually. And I'm not quite sure why, but somehow I just got quite interested in place-based, applying what it is we know, because having worked quite internationally and on the big questions, we actually know quite a lot. And wanting to bring that to a place, I live in Norwich, and mix that with other expertises as well, because there's all sorts of expertises involved in climate sustainability. It's not just people within universities. And so the Climate Commission exists, and it's a partnership with the City Council. We're independent of the City Council, but we work with them. And it's just to support, scrutinise, show new ideas, different directions, encourage, cajole, all with evidence base, to on behalf of the City Council and on behalf of Norwich citizens, how Norwich can improve, develop, and sort of take on the challenge of climate change, both in that net zero space, that decarbonisation, and adapting to the impacts of climate change, reducing the risk of climate change for Norwich. And we are currently 10 commissioners. We will expand again. There seems to be lots to do, more than we ever imagined in the last year. We're 10 commissioners of different expertises. There's, you know, sort of like, you know, university types like me. There's people who are out there in the field as consultants. We have arts organisations. We have everybody's independent of their organisation, but representative of faith organisations. So again, it's looking at climate in the round. It's not just a technical solution or a matter of economy or doing one thing instead of the other. It's about engaging and really trying to work together to show what the best pathways are into the future. At the moment, we've got four themes. One is built environments, and earlier in the interview I talked a little bit about East Norwich, so we're quite focusing on how East Norwich can be ripe for a climate future. We have citizen engagement, which hopefully speaks to its describes what it is. Within that, there's a network called Our Power, and Our Power is currently working with leaders of community groups work with them, and then hopefully things will be passed on. It's all early days for the Commission, so we're seeing how everything develops. Adaptation, reducing the risks of climate change in Norwich, that's the an area that I lead as well. And the other one, kind of obvious one, is energy.
Yes.
Is those four. So that's what we've got at the moment. We will expand, we'll do more, but right now I think we've got plenty to do in sort of consolidating those spaces. And I think one of the many enjoyable things about the Norwich Climate Commission is how it's bringing me into contact with really good, interesting, valuable Norwich-based or Norfolk-based groups, organisations, institutions that are either engaging with climate change in some way or want to engage with climate change in some way. I mean, just a yesterday afternoon, we were very enjoyable at Norwich Theatre. So they're programming a whole year around climate stories, all sorts of activities from youngsters to traditional traditional theatre goers who are maybe sort of going more for the art area. So and lots of engagement. There's going to be lots of discussions, having writer circles, all sorts of things. So that's a whole year of activity in the arts space, which is obviously citizen engagement, not telling people what to think, but what to think about. And yeah, the arts have such a important role, I think, with climate, as for people to make sense of it all. Yeah, my graphs don't necessarily make sense of things for people. They just show what the result is or the pathway is. And so that's fabulous. That's really interesting that they're doing that. Nothing to do with the commission. They're just doing this. This is something they want to do because it's important, and it's important to the society where Norwich Theatre is based. And here at the UEA, the Sainsbury Centre for Contemporary Visual Art, the art centre here, they've now got a curator dedicated to 3 years of climate change, a climate change dedicated curator. And I think it's next year, 2024, there'll be a whole big exhibitions, climate-related, sustainability-related arts things. So there's the bread-and-butter work of the commission, but there's also so much, lots of very interesting other work going on that I'm able to engage with that I wouldn't have otherwise if I hadn't started doing this very place-based work and trying to support and work with all these other people that are doing their own things anyway, other expertises that aren't sitting in this university.
Do you know, I can... just a couple more questions, but I can see the beginnings, actually, of a very interesting panel recording later in perhaps in the year with yourself and people like Saul Humphrey. I don't know if you know Saul.
The architect, yes.
And a very big voice on sustainability, like Clark Willis, who took me around the Food Enterprise Park, showed me the vertical farms, and is, you know, such what I call an agrofuturist. And I can think of the trouble is you can think of so many people and you end up with needing a very big table. Suffolk County Council, I noted on the podcast last week, set itself a carbon budget for net zero by 2030. Now, is that an effective way, do you think? I don't want to criticise them because they're taking action. But how can residents and businesses elsewhere in the east of England encourage local authorities to follow that example if that's a positive thing? It seems like a positive thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, lots of councils, district councils, local authorities have set themselves carbon budgets. Norwich, certainly. I think maybe Norfolk has. I'm not quite sure about Norfolk. Certainly some of the district councils in Norfolk have. and elsewhere. Cut a long story short, there's probably about 400 and something of the 600 and something local authorities in, I think, England and Wales, I don't think I'm including Scotland, declared climate emergencies sort of 2018, 2019, probably mostly 2019, and then COVID struck.
Yes.
And in line with those climate emergencies, a lot of them set themselves carbon budgets as well. Mm-hmm. And that was in 2019, say, and we're now 2023, and say that's quite a long time. And a lot of them places set carbon budgets for 2030, which is steep. Those are really big reductions, especially with 5 years in from when a lot of the organisations set carbon budgets. But carbon budgets are a central part of the toolkit for reducing emissions. So the UK, under the Climate Change Act, has a carbon target, has a carbon budget, and then sitting under that, theoretically, not that every local authority has, could be lots of local authorities with their bit of their carbon budget, which sits under the big carbon budget. It's just like a budget.
You've got the
amount, and then how do you achieve that amount? They're science-based targets for large organisations. I worked with a university on its carbon budgets. Lots of universities have got carbon budgets, so they're a very important tool for guiding the path, well, not the pathway, but the direction of travel, and then. More important, probably, is actually what are the pathways? How do you make that happen? Mm. But having that budget as a framework is I'm not going to say it's critical, but it's very, very useful to be able to monitor and measure what it is you're achieving. For listeners, I should point out I'm waving my hands at you.
It's
right
very
now.
I'm sort of spellbound by the indication.
I'm drawing graphs for Mike with my hands. And most of those carbon budgets look like a very, and I think Tom Bristow used this quote, a very precipitous ski slope. They're a ski slope that you wouldn't really want to ski down because it's so steep. But they absolutely are a very central tool for knowing what it is you're wanting to achieve, and then more important is how you're going to achieve that.
Well, I don't know if I should apologise to all those councils I didn't mention, or congratulate Suffolk County Council for getting its carbon budget to my eyeballs and microphone. Just going to close by saying, first of all, thank you, Asher Minns, for a fascinating discussion. I really enjoy those ones where I feel like there's still a lot more we could unpack. And I'd love to put you around a table with other people and basically just set you off to designing the future almost, and how we should be adapting. But I suppose this is a slightly self-serving final question: is what can the Eastern Promise podcast do, hopefully to be a part of the Eastern Promise Community Interest Company, to support the Tyndall Centre and the Norwich Climate Commission in doing what you're doing and sort of spreading the word, both the good news and the clarion call, if you like, that we've been discussing? What can we do to help, really, I suppose?
So if we think media in general, in whatever way we want, but of course, but your audience is an attentive audience because they're a tuning in audience, is certainly the media is help people with what to think about, not necessarily what to think, but what to think about. Now, one of the things that I would like to play with, and I have this in my mind with the Climate Commission, not done anything with it, but it's in my mind, is a lot of people in climate change will say, what we need is more climate stories. There's not enough climate stories. There's a lot of hand-waving, there's big picture stuff, there's blame the policymakers, blame the fossil fuel organisations. There's these sort of big narratives, but that doesn't tell us about where we live and who we are and who we know and what's within our sphere of influence. And so I would like, in some way, is to have a lot more local stories about climate change to change that narrative to make it locally relevant and about within people's spheres of influence and what it is they love. Yeah, what do we care about? What we care about is what it is we love, really. Mm-hmm. And so I think any, as you, I think you're doing anyway, and you're just talking about Suffolk County Council, is local issues, local stories about climate change to help make it real and accessible and relevant, which global carbon emissions, Paris Agreement, global warming targets, UK climate change acts, they're a long way from everybody apart from people like me. Whereas for everybody else, I think there's a lot of storytelling and sense making and highlighting the good stories and asking questions where things aren't going as they should do, perhaps. And based on what you already said, exactly that. It is the 70th anniversary. We're right at the end of January. It's the 70th anniversary of the 1953 flood. There was a bigger flood in December 2013 than the 1953 flood. Quite a lot of damage, but nobody died. No big damage. And that's because the east of England became defended because of what happened in 1953, and the systems were improved and the sea walls were improved. So this stuff can be dealt with much more place-based and locally than perhaps those big, big global questions and big, big national questions. That all has to be there as well. But storytelling where it is that we are, I think, is a really large part of what can change now that we're becoming more place-based.
Ash and Minns, it's been a pleasure. Thank you ever so much for your time. Thank you for your patience in waiting for me to leg it up the University Drive. And all the best to you and everything you're doing with both the Climate Commission in Norwich and here at the University.
Thank you, Mike. Really nice to speak to you.
I am hugely grateful to Ash and Minns for his time and for his analysis not only of the challenge ahead, but also for the huge opportunities within. Launched in 2022 at the University of East Anglia, Changemakers is a programme that aims to inspire business ideas that will help change people's lives, the environment, and communities for the better. The programme, run by Finbar Carter and Sophie Cox, challenges UEA students and recent graduates to submit a 60-second pitch of their business ideas, which were then opened to a public vote. The top ideas were then enrolled in an 8-week accelerator programme and given £1,000 in funding to grow and test out their ideas. On the 16th of March 2023, this year's cohort of changemakers got ready to make their final pitches to a distinguished panel of judges in front of an audience of supporters, mentors and well-wishers. There's a lot at stake. A further £3,000 of funding to launch their business, with attendees also able to vote for a People's Champion prize of £1,500. The 2023 Changemakers had no intention of making it easy for the judges, with a wide and inspiring range of ideas, from upcycling waste to better management of global water resources. I went along to meet the 2023 Changemakers and to watch them in action.
So my name's Ali, and I'm here to pitch a project called Planet, which is a social enterprise that supports young people with learning disabilities make the transition from children's services into adult life.
That's absolutely fantastic, and of course very close to my heart on a personal level. But so Planet, and obviously you've given me a good idea of what it does, but how does it do
how
it?
How does it do
is
it?
A better question.
Absolutely. So generally, when a child or young person starts to approach the age of 18, families are usually thinking about the long term, what they want in terms of support for their child as they grow older. and young people are starting to think like any other young person about their own dreams and aspirations, what they would like to do when they grow up. Unfortunately, the support that's available through social services is not adequate at the moment. We all know there's a social care crisis. People are not getting the upfront advice and support that they need at that early stage to understand the options, the various different models of funding, the various different types of support that are out there for those young people. So our service proposes to use a portion of the social care funding that is attached to each young person during that transitional age range to work with them for a period of 3 to 6 months, to work together with their friends, their family members, other professionals that are involved, and bring the whole thing together into a plan for an aspirational adult life.
And is this just a certain overall service or a platform, an electronic platform? It sounds like it's a service.
It is a service, right. Yeah, absolutely. So each young person would have their own advisor who would work directly with them and their family. It's one of the gaps that we know exists at the moment. There are lots of platforms out there. There's lots of advice for those families who have the capacity to go and find it. But what a lot of families have told us is that actually what they want is someone to sit down with them and talk them through it. So that's what we're going to do.
And I think a lot of families get exhausted by the battles that they'll have had with the local authorities all the way through.
Yeah, and you typically find that when a child starts to approach the age of 18, the family have already battled through the process of getting something called an EHCP.
I know what an EHCP is.
Yep, lots of people do. It's an exhausting process.
It is.
And then as the end of education starts to arrive, you've then got what looks like another battle on your hands to work out what's going to happen after school, after college, and that's where we come in.
I'm going to ask you this question. I might cut it out depending on the answer, but do you look at things like trust funds and provision, obviously, to look after when the parents no longer can?
Yes, absolutely. The long-term planning is very much part of what we do. A lot of the support that people receive from social care, just because of the lack of capacity, tends to be very short term. It's like, what are we going to do right now to fix this crisis? We're all about the long term. So we look with each young person at the resources that they have available. That may be from their family, from personal money, from social care money, or for those people with less of an available income within their family, we would be looking at grant funding, charitable trusts, ways that they can find additional money, bringing all of that together to put together a package of support that really works for the young person and that is sustainable throughout their life.
That is absolutely fantastic. And I can tell listeners from experience, this is so needed. This is so needed. There are so many parents drained from the fight and so many more don't even have the capacity to suit up for it in the first place. So what you're doing is so important. Thank you so much. It's so good to meet you here. I'm going to take some details offline. So congratulations and the best of luck for tonight.
Thank you.
Shiroz Dogar. And which project are you? Badia?
Yeah, Badia app. This is an app. This specializes in students identifying their hobbies and interests so they can be matched with various students and talk through it. So we understand that mental well-being is a major issue right now, with university students not talking, and it has been really lonely right now. And our service, with the primary survey that we did for the University of East Anglia students, 65% of them identified themselves as introverts. So they do not want to socialize in big events, right, and in larger events. And 71% at that time reported as being lonely. So what we did was we made an app where you write, for example, your top five hobbies are football, hockey, and movies, horror movies and all. So what we do is we match students with those interests and make a group chat where they can talk and talk about stuff about the hobbies and interests. And moreover, we have events designed up with talking through the local organizers and with the universities, student union, so they can organize events through our app for the students, so they can have they can talk more and invest.
Don't worry. Yeah.
I'll edit it.
So they can talk and make meaningful connections while they're at the university, rather than, you know, going out and meet, because it's not for everyone, right? Going out and meeting, many of the students feel shy in the first month of the uni and they just feel homesick. So we can just they can make a group chat and where they can talk and have a meaningful conversation and, you know, make friends out of like the ones with they relate to the most, because many students are not good with the course mates or with the flatmates, because in my flatmates most of the university students just don't talk to them, don't talk to each other because they just have different hobbies and different interests. Someone just someone likes to go out, someone just wants to stay in. So this app specializes in people just talking with each other what they like feel like most. Yeah.
So it really breaks down those barriers, and I know you don't have to just like rely on Freshers Week. I'm dating myself now because I sort of started you know, just as people get started getting mobile phones, because I was leaving university. So yeah, you've really, you know, you're really looking at bringing down those barriers. What can be, you're right, a very lonely experience.
Yeah, it can be. I'm an international student, and my friend, also my flatmate, we both like came up because we didn't have friends in the beginning. So we wanted. I love cricket, and many students here do not like cricket, and I've not met them. So I wanted to we all wanted to make something that we can interact with people that like things that we like. So that is why we just came up with this app, and we have like 150 users signed up to download the app. And if you can have a look at the framework and how we will match students and everything with the revenue model set up, and right now we'll pitch in half an hour, I think, and we will tell the judges how we're gonna make this app the biggest app for all the universities.
Yeah. Well, have you found a good cricket club?
Yeah, I have.
Good.
Where's that one?
The
UEA Cricket Club.
Hey, well, there you are. Perfect. Thank you very much. Best of luck.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Well, Claire Montgomery, it's great to see you at the UEA Changemakers event. It must seem a very long time since Sink the City.
It certainly does. It has been quite a roller coaster since then.
So tell us something about the twists, the turns.
Well, straight afterwards, Sophie Cox from the Enterprise Centre said, come and look at the Changemakers programme. So we did put a video together for that and we got some votes and got onto the programme. And so the last 2 months have been absolutely an absolute whirlwind of speaking to people, our questionnaire, and I mean, we've spoken to something like 35 experts in health, well-being, medical tech, the Norfolk Network. They've been a huge support. And then last week, I haven't announced this yet, but last week we got a Grow It grant for £7,500.
Oh, wow.
So we've got that, and so we're on the road now to creating a prototype, which is where we are now, and depending on where tonight goes as well.
Well, it's been so fascinating to, even just through the very limited medium of LinkedIn, to see sort of the odd post that you just think, yes, because I feel silly, but because I was at Sink the City and we talked to you there and you're on the podcast, feel slightly invested, not in the way that actually would be useful to you, but we feel slightly invested in seeing you take this as far as it could go. You've mentioned the grant, but and you've mentioned the prototype, so where next post-prototype?
So I think, I mean, the critical thing is now proving that our idea can deliver the data that we need. So that is absolutely fundamental. But then after that, if we can do that, then we can start to build an MVP and create something that we can then go for further funding for. Because obviously it's a very expensive app. It will be. And so we'll need to get additional funding in order to take it further.
Well, you clearly caught the imagination of Amber Sisson on the judges panel. So many questions. Has she been allowed out of seclusion to ask you them? Oh, so you're stealing yourself. You're shaking your head and you're stealing yourself for that moment. She powers across to you.
Yes.
and threw things about you. Well, all I'll say to you is, I know from experience that what you're doing is very, very important and is very much needed. If I can say those kind of things, so I get twitchy as a sort of white male liberal guilt going, what have I done? And the 1 in 3 women know nothing about the perimenopause. I think naught out of any number you like of men. Eastern Promise will always have an open mic for you as and when you want it, as and when you need it, because, say, we saw you at Sink the City. What a fabulous thing you're doing. It goes for the same of all the changemakers here. But, you know, we've had you on before. You're always welcome on again. Claire Montgomery, I will now bring this babble to a close. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thomas Panton. It's great to see you. Always great to see a former guest of Eastern Promise. And you're here at the UEA Changemakers event, the grand finale. Why are you here?
I think, firstly, it's awesome to see the next generation of impact entrepreneurs coming out of the UEA. That's where we started. Also, I was really lucky to advise and mentor one of the cohort this year as someone who's gone through that journey of pitching short pitches in an impact space. So, yeah, just really looking forward to seeing some the next generation of impact entrepreneurs.
And where is this can often be about not just about the winning, but the opportunity of taking part. So where do you see this year's cohort of changemakers going from here?
Mainly the big thing is collaboration and partnerships. Like, we're really seeing a shift in the way that industry works to working together more than like competing against everyone. And I think that there's a lot of synergy between lots of the different cohort this year. But also they've just come together as sort of a big family of founders. And I think often that's where the value is in these sorts of things. So what I'd like to see is them to continue working together, continue supporting each other, and all of them the best of luck and success.
Well, you'll have been a really great source. I know you will have been a great source of inspiration and a great mentor. And you must be really proud tonight. And I hope that the ones you support come through. But I know you'll be rooting for all of them. Thomas Panton, thank you. Finn Evans, Chudatsi. For those who were unlucky enough not to be here tonight, tell us more about what Chudatsi is and what you do.
Chudatsi, first of all, from Bulgarian, it means to wander, to explore. And that's what we are wanderers. We are a team of passionate minority artists that are also knowledgeable in academia, and we hope to represent minorities through film, theater, and publishing stories. I hope that
that's perfect. And you've got some of your works out here on the table. We got Real Boy, Scrounge, the play about Theresa May. What an important story. What an important thing to do to tell those stories of marginalised genders. Some people might think it's quite limited, but it's actually quite a rich tapestry if you actually look into it. So how important is it for you to be able to go out there and tell those stories?
Well, it's quite important when it comes to misrepresentation that sometimes happens, and we want to challenge that. We want people to be educated on certain topics about race, disability, sexuality, gender, etc. And this is why we do it. We want to share stories, we want to educate, and we want to help people find their communities to feel represented and loved there.
Through understanding comes acceptance, and through acceptance comes a peaceful,
exactly,
prosperous world. Sorry, can I grab your name? I saw it on the board, but I can't remember what it was.
It's fine, it's Jesse.
Jesse, hello Jesse. So what's your role in Chudatsi?
I've been helping with the marketing, and I'm also a UEA creative amongst many of the team, so I help on the creative side as well. And I've been, you can see on the screen, but people can't, that I was an actor in Real Boy, the first production that we put on. I played Real Boy himself. So tell
us about Real Boy.
I can do. Well, there were two main ways that we can kind of describe it. One is that it's a play about the trans experience and trans lives, trans rights, why it's so important to affirm people and trans youth, and the dangers of what happens if you don't. And the other way to look at it is that it's a story that other people outside of the trans experience can relate to in terms of things like people-pleasing, pressures, any kind of social pressure to not be yourself, to be what's normal and what's easy for other people.
It is really, that pressure is really debilitating, just speaking from a neurodiverse point of view. It is completely debilitating, and you do start to worry, am I doing too much of this, am I doing not enough of that, and what have I missed cues, what's going on? So the play about, I want to know about the play of Theresa May, and it's Amy Marie.
Hi there. So a lot of us on the Chudatsi team actually have won awards for various things because we're all artists. Some of us are writers. I'm a writer. I won the Norfolk Arts Awards for new writing last year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Finn is a fantastic cinematographer. I'm so excited for Finn, who is our kind of speaker today, to adapt a lot of these scripts, these theatre scripts, into films, and have that as another way that we can get these stories out to people who aren't able to come to in-person events. So I've got a very real play about being disabled and being thought of as a scrounger in our society, and that is going to be one of the plays following Real Boy that Chudatsi is putting on, touring filming and making an actual cinematography version of. So big project. But the play about Theresa May, the one you came over for.
No, I didn't come over for that. I just saw it when I got here and I was like, oh.
What is that? So that's actually my first published work that I ever did. That's a political piece. It's a comedy, unlike Scrounge. And that was actually put on and toured while Theresa May was Prime Minister. And every single day it was updated to include what had happened that week. So it was a very busy piece with absolutely everything from the day she stood at the podium and said, it's hard to be a woman, and then didn't make anything better for women, to right up to the end when she gave up.
Right.
So it is a comedy. My favourite thing about that show in particular is halfway through the tour, as part of a marketing stunt, we went to the House of Parliament, we snuck inside on a tour, and we were in the costumes, and then we sat in the House of Parliament and started doing a scene, and we were escorted out because they thought we might have been doing terrorism.
Well, I worked there for 15 years, and I was never escorted out, yeah. So you're one up on me. Wow, I mean, it's fantastic to have that kind of no-holds-barred theatre being created in our region, and congratulations, and it's really great to have you. I wish you all the best. Mitra Tanamand, who has been recycling glass and all manner of objects into fantastic artworks and jewellery. Congratulations on making the Changemakers Grand Final.
Thank you so much.
And where did this originate from, this idea of turning other people's junk into someone else's jewellery, someone else's art?
Well, actually, it was my passion. When I arrived to UK, I was thinking to do something like to express my inner feelings. And then I was thinking about the waste management. So I realized that there are a lot of cardboards around, the garbage is around, so why not should I use that? And then I realized that the refugees are one of the people who are like isolated in the hotel rooms. And to empower them, to encourage them to come together and improve our community and also involved with the arts.
What I love about doing this podcast is I encounter so many people who work so hard to do good things for the community around them, and you obviously fall very squarely into that bracket. I mean, are you sort of building like a cooperative of artists around you and sharing your skills?
Yeah, actually, it's like that. It's kind of it's an organization to encourage people to come together, and actually, it's a community because I would like to improve that community with myself and invite the people to encourage us, to support us, to purchase our products. And this is one of the options and one of the reason that I have for doing this.
And I think it's great that you sort of take a refugee story and make it quite so personal, because once people sort of understand and get to know the person behind the label, then that changes people's minds completely.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point that I have at the moment.
So I summarised it for you then. And is are you sort of studying at the UEA or are you a graduate?
Actually, I'm doing my PhD in the university, and I'm on a scholarship. Yeah, I'm doing education and gender under international development.
All right. So, well, best of luck with that. That's a bit massive. And it's fantastic to see you tonight. And, you know, the family feel of the Changemakers has come across all too clearly. So really, we wish you Eastern Promise every success in your forward endeavours.
Thank you so much.
Best of luck in the future as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Mary, you are the Water Cooperation Network master student here at the UEA, originally from Bolivia. Just recap for us briefly, quickly, if you could. What was it that drew you to the Changemakers program? But first of all, before you get to that, tell us, what is the Water Cooperation Network?
Okay, sure. Thank you very much. Water Cooperation Network is a web app that has been designed to build capabilities and empower water providers in developing countries, specifically. Through this web app, they will have the opportunity to access to tools, information, and to a whole experts network, so they can receive the support, the technical support they need to improve their services.
And so it's really, really important, because, you know, that need for water is an existential thing. Oh, we're being summoned back in. So the need for water is existential. So you're clearly moving forward really rapidly. And have you got lots of support from some water providers in this country and other parts of the of both the Western and the developing world?
About the water providers, I am just started doing my primary research with water companies that are in my country, in Bolivia, based in Bolivia, because this is the context that I know really well.
Yeah.
I've been working in this area, in this sector, for the last 10 years of my career. But about the water experts, because I did also another primary research with them, I consulted with experts from 6 different countries. So it was really a really nice input for me and for this.
Well, Mary, I think we're going to get drowned out, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, Finbar Carter, here we are at the Enterprise Centre in the Lecture Theatre. What a parade of awesome was that.
Yeah, so proud of these guys. And considering we've only been working them since January, they blew me away. And I think there was a lot of nerves and a lot of excitement, but actually seeing and hearing from them all, like the potential for these guys to go on and create great change in the world is amazing. And I think the audience could feel how much we've done already. Well, how much they've done, not we've done.
I mean, yeah, the audience was so absolutely, totally four square behind every one of them. And what a lovely sort of family feel. There wasn't the sense of this has come over in interviews already, but there was no sense of competition. It's much more about collaboration.
And I think this is really key in terms of the social venture sector. It's very different from traditional business, I would say. Now, that doesn't mean there's not collaboration in the traditional business sector, but in terms of social enterprise, it's all about partnerships and working together. And we set out from the start that actually, although there will be one winner tonight, it doesn't matter about that. It's about the cohort. And so we've worked really hard with them and built a community, and they kind of chat regularly on WhatsApp. They've been meeting up, supporting one another. And you could just see how much support they were giving to each other during the presentations alone.
I mean, you've obviously got a lot of support from organisations like ADNAMS.
Sorry.
No. Just go. You've obviously got a lot of support from Santander. And I'm glad I didn't say ADNAMS just now because I saw it in your bottle and I got distracted. You got a lot of support from organisations like Santander. What does it mean to have those organisations on board? Is it basically existential to running something like this?
Yeah. I mean, universities are all struggling financially since Brexit and other matters in terms of our numbers. And so having external money to support these programmes is essential. And we only gave each business £1,000, but £1,000 at that very early stage is so critical to be able to build prototypes, create branding, and just put themselves out there. And in fact, we were doing some reviews earlier, and one of the things they said was the most valuable was the funding. And so actually we know it makes a huge difference. And we're so lucky. Santander have been working with us for years. And it's not just about the money. They're passionate about social ventures as well. Although they might be a traditional bank, they're passionate about social ventures. And they've made it one of their key criteria in terms of the business they support. So, yeah, we couldn't thank them enough.
What I think is incredible is the breadth of topics, of types of venture. And it's not all just tech-focused, although there is a tech element to it. Where did the idea of that come from, having that sort of that broad approach?
We work with all sorts of students and graduates already, and we know that tech's popular, but actually we know a lot of tech businesses don't work. You know, there's a very high failure rate in apps. We're passionate about supporting any students and graduates with whatever ideas they have. I guess over the 10 years I've been here that we've seen more and more social and environmental businesses, but we didn't want to tie it down. So we made it very open, ideas that make a difference to people, planet or community. And you can see they are very broad, but they represent the students who come from all sorts of study all across the world and different personal backgrounds. And it's nice. It's not just tech. It's all sorts. It's a real rich tapestry. Yeah.
I think the global element you pick up on that brilliantly because it was a very global, a very international flavour to that, and that was wonderful. That was really, really heartwarming to see not just that international community be embraced in this institution, in the UEA, but to really want to give back and to focus on the wider community, but not just here. The global community almost.
Yeah, I mean, so we had students from Bolivia, India, Nigeria, Afghanistan, all across the globe, Bulgaria, probably missed a few out. And part of our mission isn't just to support UK-based businesses, because a lot of our graduates go home to their home country, and we support them. But also, we know the change doesn't just need to happen here. It needs to happen across the globe. And many of our businesses have big visions to be across the globe, or some of them just want to be working in their locality where they know best. That's kind of a part of our wider mission, I guess.
So how long has tonight been in the planning? It seems like it's been, are you going to go home and then put a sort of warm, damp towel over your head?
Yeah. I think we all need to rest and recover. So the programme launched, we kind of put the publicity out, I think, October time. So we've kind of been building up from them, getting noise about it, getting submissions in. And then since January, we're working them intensely. This is on top of everything else we do. So today's intense, and it's been a lot of work. Luckily, I've got a great team, but we are all probably going to be resting tomorrow.
Well, it was great showmanship tonight, and you made me wish I'd come to the UEA. But Finn Barkata, go and enjoy the rest of the evening. Thank you very much for speaking to Eastern Promise.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Congratulations to Mary Artega Gonzalez Garcia, who scooped the £3,000 Changemakers Award, and to Deborah Adesina, who successfully topped the £1,500 People's Choice vote. Deborah Adesina.
Debbie the Joy Giver, winner of the People's Choice. You're holding the trophy, which unfortunately people can't see, but you're very clearly very happy with the trophy. This fantastic People's Choice Award. You told us you're the joy giver.
Yes.
And you, I have to say, was the most joyful presentation on stage quite easily. Where's that joy coming from?
Actually, joy comes from Jesus, to be honest, from God. Because yesterday I was tired, exhausted, sick. I thought I was going to miss this or skip it. But I just had that peace in my spirit that what I'm doing is much more than the competition. It's bringing joy, and joy comes from only one source. And I'm happy and privileged to be the one to bring that joy, to share it to the world, share it with Eastbourne. Yeah, so that's the true source. I have no joy of my own. But yeah, he gives me all the joy.
Well, you were certainly sharing that joy tonight. And it's lovely to see you talking about Eastbourne as well, because I'm there in 2 weeks' time. I know it very well. So. What I thought was extraordinary about what you're doing is it's an area that many people, talking to the elderly, that I think there's a fear that you kind of were kind of scotching or putting to one side, that people get frightened of the, you know, as I am, so shall you be kind of thing. So it was your confidence and your joy and your love for these people, and you wanting to bring them something and getting them out and getting them active. Has that got a particular origin?
Naturally, I'm exciting. I'm always. People say the first thing they say about me is, "Oh, you light up the room. You bring up so much energy." And when I got into Eastbourne, it felt like a really quiet town with lots of old people. And I noticed that in church, I used to smile a lot, and a lot of old people naturally warmed up to me. And then. Because I come from Nigeria, we value elderly people, and we see it as our responsibility to actually reach out, make their lives comfortable, because this is something they did for us as children. So that cultural part of me, that personality part of me, and the fact that I love music and dance.
We are demonstrating right now, which, again, I'm being treated to. You can't see this. Tough luck.
Yes, so all of those factored in, made me... teach this idea.
It is. You are doing something so important and so needed to make those connections and help people sort of to see that there's still joy and love to be had, even when you sort of advanced in years, and that you're here at the UEA and you're taking that to Eastbourne, which is another place close to my heart.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you.
By sheer energy on stage alone, that's a worthy winner.
Thank you. All glory to him. Thank you.
Dr. Nicola Hancock.
That's right.
Head judge at this fantastic evening, the Changemakers Grand Final That must have been a very, very tough decision.
It was incredibly difficult. They all had tremendous strengths in different areas, and there were just a couple that rose to the top that had addressed all of them. But goodness me, it was tough in that judging room, I can tell you.
Were you kind of all moving in slightly one direction, or did there have to be a bit of debate and discussion first?
Oh, I think I wouldn't want to reveal our techniques.
Sorry, I'm crying.
No, absolutely. I think certainly we had some that really were stacking towards the top as we began to talk. Yes, and it would be fair to say that the final decision was absolutely unanimous, yes.
So what does it mean to you to be asked to come along and judge something like this, that there's all these fantastic... There's obviously such a family developing around the cohort this year. To be able to sort of not just have a, sort of a role sort of picking out winners and winners, but just to be part of that family, slightly on the outside, but still so much part of the mix.
Yes, well, very much part of the UEA family as the Associate Pro Vice Chancellor for Innovation. It makes me incredibly proud. I'm inspired by every single one of the narratives we've heard about tonight. This is a phenomenal group of people, and I feel really safe in their hands for the future.
That is an absolutely brilliant thought to end on. What a fantastic group of people. So many ideas, so many community-spirited ideas for improving the places we live, the world around us.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, thank Nicola Hancock.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
I'm very grateful to Finbar Carter, Sophie Cox, and all the 2023 cohort of changemakers, judges, mentors, and supporters. It was a truly uplifting evening, showcasing the huge passion behind world-class ideas alongside what might seem a strange concept, that collaboration trumps competition every time. I'm already looking forward to seeing what the 2024 cohort of changemakers can achieve. And now, sport. It's an unusual topic for me to cover, as I am to sport what boxing gloves are to virtuoso piano playing. But to you, my crowd sorcerers, it can be a source of much-needed endorphins, bringing both physical and mental fitness. So, where in the east of England do you go to enjoy your personal sporting preferences? Let's go into extra time for some
crowd sorcery.
Yes, crowd sorcery. Let's kick off Yeah, see what I did there, yeah? With someone who's not just active, but actively looking to expand his activeness into all new activities. It's Tom Abbott of sustainable consultancy GreenEasy. Thanks for the mention, Mike and Eastern Promise, says Tom. There are many sports I love. My main sports are running and football, but I'm thinking about getting a paddleboard to use in my village, as the River Waveney is about 500 metres from my house. Please, can someone tell me how polluted this river is, and should this be a concern? I think that should concern us all, Tom, and I hope you've managed to get the assurances you seek. Joining me in eschewing the competitive nature of sport is marketing mage Laura Quelch of LQD Magic. Or is that Liquid Magic? I'm not sure. Says Laura, I prefer the fun side of sport, so just getting moving for a laugh with others. I'm not a fan of when people take it too seriously. As Yoga with Adrienne says, find what feels good. Someone who's clearly taken Laura's advice to heart is business development professional David Fieldhouse, although not so much recently. David says, well, currently limping around with an injured knee from getting clean and jerks wrong in the gym, so they're off the agenda for now. Otherwise, general gym work, hitting 10k plus steps a day, sparring and pad work twice a week, and surfing a couple of times a year, all of which keeps me happy. Blimey, David, take it easy. If anyone asks, what on earth is this racket? Then they can turn to Michelle Chambers, Business Development Manager at Chaplin Farrant, who says, "Love playing table tennis at home, running in my village, and badminton is my favourite, but stopped playing over a year ago, and I really need to get back to it." You know, Engineer 49's other half is a demon with a bat, and old 49 himself is a badminton whiz, so you have been warned. But let's end on a fantastic blend of sports volunteering for young'uns, as well as championing the power of sport and activity to boost well-being. It's that genial gentleman of business, Brian Bush, who takes pleasure in the beautiful game. "Football for me," says Brian. "Player, coach, Tasborough under-18s, occasional lino, Mulbarton reserves, and viewer of Second Son as Lacton under-13s, and the mighty NCFC, and a boyhood connection with West Ham. Then, as you kindly reference," oh, you're welcome, Brian, "Walk to Run Wellness CIC, partnering with and on site at Broom Boats Limited." Brian says, "This is a new project working with people with medical conditions to model through a holistic health program to improve well-being and reduce drug dependency. Working with NHS Norfolk and Waveney Integrated Care Board, we are developing our specialist interventions across the clinical landscape. Please do drop Brian a line if you would like to know more." Go! What are you waiting for? Get in touch with Brian via LinkedIn or put Walk to Run Wellness CIC into your search engine of choice. And on that public service announcement, episode 58 of Eastern Promise draws to a close. I've been Mike Rigby, and thank you once again to Asher Minns for giving us the climate lowdown, laced with optimism about the potential for the future of our region. I'm obliged as ever to all my crowd sorcerers and to Engineer 49. To an optimist, the glass is half full. To a pessimist, the glass is half empty. To Engineer 49, the glass is twice as big as it needs to be. Next week, we'll be welcoming David Powells, former editor of the Eastern Daily Press, former head of news at ITV Anglia, Mike Talbot, and course director for broadcast journalism at the University of East Anglia, Claire Preecy, to discuss the future of local journalism. I'll also be chatting to some of Claire's students and finding out, spoiler alert, why the future of local journalism in the east of England is in very safe hands. That's all to come next week. Catch you then, so bye for now. Eastern Promise is a Priors Croft production for the Eastern Promise East Anglia Community Interest Company.